the wall. His music had an odd floating quality to it. It seemed to fade into a distance, as if it were leaking into a place I could not access. Chade's hand on my wrist distracted me.
What did you do to him last night? Did you cause this sickness, do you think?
His query shocked me, and I answered it aloud. No, no, I think this is just the result of his seasickness, his nights on deck in the rain and a lack of food. Fick had perhaps been aware of our skilling. He rolled his head towards us and looked at me balefully. Then his eyes sank shut again. Chade moved away, motioning for me to follow. He sank down onto a well-padded bench built beneath one of the windows and indicated I should sit close beside him. The prince had been setting out game pieces for stones. Now he lifted his gaze to regard us curiously.
Strange that speaking softly may be the best way to keep this private.
Chade pointed out the window as if bidding me observe something. I leaned forward and nodded. He smiled and spoke quietly near my ear.
I could not sleep last night. I've been practicing skill exercises on my own. I fancy that I've become more attuned to it. Fick's music was strong and wild. Then I sensed something. Someone. You, I thought. But there was another presence. One I thought I had glimpsed before. It grew stronger, more masterful. Then Fick's music calmed.
A part of me was astounded that Chade was strong enough in the skill to have witnessed anything. I didn't think fast enough, and I was silent for too long before I asked innocently, "Another presence?" Chade smiled toothily.
"Nettle, I think. You are bringing her into the coterie this way?"
"Not really," I said, and it was like a wall collapsing, this surrendering of my secret to Chade. I resented it. And yet I could not deny the relief that I felt to speak of it. I was tired of my secrets, I realized abruptly. Too tired to protect them any more. Let him know of Nettle and her strength. It didn't mean I'd allow her to be used. I asked a favor of her. I needed to let her know that Swift was safe and that I'd watch over him. Before we left Buckkeep, I told her that he was coming home, because that was what I believed. When I discovered he'd come aboard with Webb, well, I couldn't leave her in suspense, wondering if her brother were dead in a ditch somewhere.
"Of course not," Chade murmured.
His eyes glinted with hunger for information. I fed it. In return, I asked that she soothe Thick's nightmare. She seems very skilled at controlling her own dreams. Last night she proved capable of controlling someone else's. I watched his face as avidly as he watched mine. I saw him ponder the possible uses of such a thing, saw sparks kindle as he recognized how powerful a weapon it could be. To take control of the images in a man's mind, to guide his unguarded thoughts into channels grim and daunting, or uplifting and lovely. What could not be done with such a tool? One could craze a man with nightly terrors, inspire a wedding alliance based on romantic dreams, or poison an alliance with suspicions. "No," I said quietly. "Nettle is unaware of the power of what she does. She does not even know it is the skill she plies. I will not bring her into the coterie, Chade." And then I told the most cunningly crafted lie I could swiftly fashion. Had he been aware of it, Chade would have been proud of me. "She will work best for us as a solo, uncognizant of the full import of what she does. She will remain more tractable, so, even as I was when I worked as an unknowing youth." He nodded gravely, not bothering to deny the truth of it. I saw then a blind spot in my mentor. He had loved me, and yet still used me, and still permitted me to be used. Perhaps just as he had been used. He did not guess that I would shield Nettle from such a fate.
"I am glad you have come to see that that is for the best," he said approvingly.
"What's out there?" the prince asked curiously. He rose to come and stare out of the window. Chade replied some nonsense about us playing tricks with our eyes, seeing first the ships as moving upon the water, and then blinking to make the water move beneath the ships. "And what was it that you wished to speak to us privately about?" Dutiful asked curiously. Chade took a breath, and almost I saw him scrabble for a topic. I think this is an excellent arrangement. With both Thick and Fitz here, we have access to our entire coterie. I think it would be well if we let it be known that Thick has grown very attached to Fitz and wishes him near. With that excuse, it will not seem so odd for an ordinary guardsman to attend his prince so closely, even after Thick's health improves. I thought we had already discussed that, Dutiful queried.
Did we? Well, I suppose we did. Excuse an old man's wandering mind, my prince.
Dutiful made a small and sceptical noise. I made a tactful retreat to Thick's bedside. His fever had in no way abated. Chade called a servant and commanded the foods he thought would be most helpful for Thick. I thought of the surly cook I'd encountered and pitied the boy sent with the order. He returned far too soon with a cup of hot water with a piece of salt meat in the bottom of it. Chade fumed at that and sent a second serving man with terse and precise orders. I coaxed plain water into Thick and listened anxiously as his breathing grew more hoarse. The food arrived. The cook's second effort was much better than her first, and I managed to spoon some of it down Thick. His throat was sore, and swallowing pained him, so the meal was very slow. She had also, at Chade's direction, sent food for me so that I could eat without leaving his side. That became the regular pattern of my meals. It was nice to be able to eat at my leisure without competing with the rest of the guardsmen, but at the same time, it isolated me from any talk save Thick's, Chade's, and Dutiful's. I had hoped to get a solid night of sleep my first night in the prince's cabin. Thick had settled and did not toss or moan. I dared to hope that he had found his own peace. My pallet spanned the threshold to his closet. I closed my eyes, longing to find my own rest, but instead breathed deep, centered myself, and dove into Thick's dream. He wasn't alone. Kitten Thick nestled in the middle of a big bed upon his cushion, while Nettle moved quietly around the tiny room. She seemed to be busy with evening tasks. She hummed as she tidied away discarded clothing, and then set foodstuffs into the cupboards. When she was finished, the little room was neat and bright.
"There," she told the watchful kitten. "You see? All is well. Everything is where it should be and as it should be, and you are safe. Sweet dreams, little one."
She stood on her tiptoes to blow out the lamp. I had a sudden odd realization. I had known she was Nettle, but perceived her through Thick's eyes as a short, stout woman with long greying hair bundled into a knot and deep lines in her face. His mother, I realized, and knew then that she had borne him very late in her life. She looked more of an age to be his grandmother. Then Thick's dream retreated from me, as if I had gazed at a lighted window from a distance. I looked around me. We were on the hillside, the melted tower above me, and a bramble of dead briars surrounding me. Nettle stood at my side.
"I do this for him, not you," she said bluntly. "No soul should have to endure dreams so plagued with fear."
"You're angry at me?" I asked her slowly. I dreaded her answer. She did not look at me. From nowhere a cold wind blew between us. She spoke through it.
"What did they really mean, those words you told me to say to my father? Are you truly a callous beast, Shadow Wolf, that you gave me words to pierce his heart?"
"Yes." "No." I lacked a truthful answer to give her. I tried to say I would never want to hurt him. But was that true? He had taken Molly to be his own. They had believed me dead. Neither of them had intended me ill. But he had taken her from me all the same, and raised my daughter in safety and health. Yes, that was true, and I was grateful to him for that, but not grateful that she would always see his face when she heard the word Papa. "You asked me for those words," I said, and then heard how harsh I sounded.
"And just like the wishes granted in old tales, you gave me what I wanted, and it has broken my heart."
"What happened?" I asked unwillingly. She didn't want to tell me, and yet she did.
"I told him I'd had a dream, and that in the dream a wolf with porcupine quills in his nose had promised to watch over Swift and bring him safely home to us, and I said the words you gave me. As once you did, so do I now. I shelter and guide your son. I will put my life between him and any harm, and when my task is done, I will bring him safely home to you.
And?
My mother was kneading bread, and she told me not to speak of Swift if all I could talk was moonshine and foolishness. But her back was to the table where I sat with my father. She did not see his eyes widen at my words. For a time he just stared at me, with his eyes showing the whites all around them. Then he fell from the chair to the floor and lay there, staring like a corpse. I thought he was struck dead. My brothers and I carried him to his bed, fearing the worst. My mother was terrified, demanding of him where he hurt, but he did not answer. He only put his hands over his eyes, curled up like a beaten child, and began to weep. He wept all today, and did not say a word to any of us. As night fell, I heard him get up. I came to the edge of my loft and looked down. He was dressed for travel. My mother was holding to his arm, begging him not to go out, but he said to her, "Woman, you've no idea what we have done, and I haven't the courage to tell you. I'm a coward. I've always been a coward." Then he shook her off and left.
For a terrible flashing instant, I imagined Molly spurned and abandoned. It was devastating. "Where did he go?" I managed to ask her.
"I suspect he's coming to you, wherever you are."
Her words were curt, and yet I heard hope in them. Hope that someone knew where her father was bound and why. I had to take it from her. "That cannot be, but I think I know where he has gone, and I think he will come back to you soon." Buckkeep, I thought to myself. Burrick was a direct man. He'd go to Buckkeep, hoping to corner Chade and question him. He'd get Catrican instead, and she would tell him, just as she had told Dutiful who I really was, because she believed in telling people the truth, even if it hurt them. I said hastily, and then wondered if it was true. "Swift is safe, and I promise I will do all in my power to bring him home to you as soon as I can." I paused, wondering what I could safely tell her. She was no fool, this daughter of mine. Too many hints and she'd unravel the whole mystery. Like as not, then I'd lose her forever. "I knew your father, a long time ago. We were close. But I made decisions that went against his rules, and so we parted. For a long time, he has believed I was dead. With your words, he knows I am not, and because I never came back to him, he now believes he did me a great wrong." "He didn't. But if you know your father at all, you will know that it is what he believes in that regard that will drive him."
"You knew my father a long time ago. Did you know my mother then, too?"
"I knew him long before you were born." Not quite a lie, but a deception nonetheless. I let her mislead herself.
"And so my words meant nothing to my mother?"
Nettle softly concluded after a moment. "Yes," I confirmed. Then gingerly I asked, "Is she all right?"
"Of course not."
I felt her impatience with my stupidity.
"She stood outside the house and shouted after him when he left, and then ranted to all of us that she never should have married such a stiff-necked man. A dozen times she asked me what I said, and a dozen times I told her of my dream. I came so close to telling her all I knew of you, but that would not have helped, would it? For she never knew you."
For one chill instant, I saw it through Nettle's eyes. Molly stood in the road. In her struggle to restrain Burrick, her hair had come loose. It curled as it ever had, brushing against her shoulders as she shook her fist after him. Her youngest son, little more than 6, clutched at her skirts, sobbing in terror at this wild spectacle of his father abandoning his mother. The sun was setting, tinging the landscape with blood.
"You blind old fool!" Molly shrieked after her husband, and the flung words rattled against me like stones. "You'll be lost or robbed! You'll never come home to us!"
But the fading clatter of galloping hooves was her only reply. Then Nettle turned away from the scolding memory of it, and I found we were no longer on the hill with the melted tower. Instead, we were in a loft. My wolf ears, on top of my head, nearly brushed the low rafters. She was sitting up in her bed, her knees clutched to her chest. Beyond the curtain that screened us from the rest of the attic, I could hear her brothers breathing. One shifted in his sleep and cried out restlessly. No one dreamed peacefully in this house tonight. I desperately wanted to beg her to say no word of me to Molly. I dared not, for then she would be certain that I lied. I wondered how strongly she already suspected a link between her mother and myself. I did not answer her directly. I don't think your father will be gone long. When he returns home, will you tell me to put my mind at rest?
If he comes home,
she said in a low voice, and I suddenly knew that Molly had voiced aloud the family's very real fears. Now Nettle spoke reluctantly, as if speaking the truth made it more real.
He has already been robbed and beaten once when he was travelling alone seeking for Swift. He has never admitted it to us, but we all knew that is what befell him. Nevertheless, he has once more set out alone.
That's Burrick, I said. I dared not voice aloud what I hoped in my heart, that he had ridden a horse that he knew well. Although he would never use his wit to speak to his mount, that did not prevent the animals he worked with from communicating with him.
That's my father,
she agreed, both with pride and sorrow. And then the walls of the room began to run, like inked letters when tears fall on them. She was the last sight to fade from my dream. When I came to myself, I was staring up at a darkened corner of the prince's cabin, seeing nothing. In the tedious days and nights that followed, Fick's condition changed little for better or worse. He would rally for a day and a night, and then slip back into fever and coughing. His real illness had chased away his fear of seasickness, but there was no comfort for me in that. More than once I sought Nettle's aid in banishing Fick's fever dreams before they could unsettle the crew. Sailors are a superstitious lot. Under Fick's influence, they shared a nightmare, and when they compared their night's recollections, decided it was a warning from the gods. It only happened once, but was nearly enough to set off a mutiny. I worked more closely and more often on skill dreams with Nettle than I desired. She did not speak of Burrick, and I did not ask, though I knew we both counted the days that he had been gone. I knew that if she had had tidings of him, she would share them. His absence in her life left a place for me. Unwillingly, I felt our bond grow stronger, until I carried a constant awareness of her with me at all times. She taught me, without realizing, how to slip behind Fick's dreams and manipulate them, gently guiding them into consoling images. I could not do it as well as she did. Mine was more a suggestion to him, while she simply set the dream right. Twice, I felt Chade observing us. It grated on me. But there was nothing I could do about it, since to acknowledge him would have made Nettle aware of him as well. Yet in ignoring him, I profited as well, for he grew bolder. I saw my old mentor grow stronger in the skill. Did he not realize it, or did he conceal it from me? I wondered, but did not betray that wondering to him. I have never found sea travel enthralling. One watery seascape is much like any other. After a few days, the prince's cabin seemed almost as cramped, confining, and stuffy as the hold my fellow guardsmen shared. The monotonous food, the endless rocking, and my anxiety for Thick hollowed me. Our diminished coterie made little progress in our skill lessons. Swift continued to come to me daily. He read aloud, earning knowledge of the out-islands and refreshing mine as he did so. At the end of each session, I would question him to be sure the knowledge was settling into his mind and not simply passing through his eyes and out of his mouth. He had a good head for holding information and asked a few questions of his own. Swift was seldom gracious, but he was obedient to his teacher, and for now that was all I asked. Fick seemed to find Swift's presence soothing, for he would relax, and some of the lines would smooth from his brow as he listened. He spoke little, and breathed hoarsely, and would sometimes go off into coughing fits. The process of coaxing spoonfuls of broth into him exhausted both of us. The rounded paunch he had recently gained dwindled, and dark hollows showed under his small eyes. He was as sick a creature as I'd ever seen, and his acceptance of his misery was heart-wrenching. In his own mind, he was dying. and not even in his dreams could I completely vanquish that notion. Nor could Dutiful aid me in that. The prince did his best, and he was truly fond of Thick, but Dutiful was 15, and a boy in many ways still. Moreover, he was a boy being courted by his nobles, who daily devised distractions that would put him in their company. Freed of Cotricken's austere traditions, they plied him with entertainment and flattery. Smaller boats shuttled between the ships of our betrothal fleet, not only bringing nobles to visit Dutiful, but often carrying Chade and him off to the other vessels for wine and poetry and song. Such trips were meant to divert his attention from the ennui of the uneventful voyage, and they succeeded only too well. But it behoved Dutiful to distribute his favours and attentions amongst his nobles. The success of his reign would be built upon the alliances he forged now. He could scarcely have refused to go. Yet, all the same, it bothered me to see how easily his attention could be drawn away from his ill servant. Webb was my sole comfort. He came every day, offering quietly to keep watch by Thick while I took some time for myself. I could not completely relax my vigil, of course. I maintained a skill awareness of Thick, lest he sweep us all into some wild and fearful dream. But I could at least leave the confines of the cabin to stroll briefly on the deck and feel some wind in my face. This arrangement, however, kept me from having time alone with Webb. It was not just for Chade's ends that I longed to speak with him. More and more, his quiet competency and kindness impressed me. I had a sense that he courted me, not as Dutiful's nobles courted the prince, but as Burrick had insinuated himself into the presence of a horse he wished to retrain. And it worked, despite my being aware of it. With every passing day, I felt less wariness and caution toward him. It no longer seemed a threat that he knew who I really was, but almost a comfort. I harboured a host of questions I longed to ask him. How many of the old bloods knew that Fitzchivalry still lived? How many knew I was he? Yet I dared not voice such questions in Thick's hearing, even when he wandered in his fever dreams. There was no telling how he might repeat such words, aloud or in dreams. Very late one evening, when the prince and Chade had returned from some entertainment, I waited until Dutiful had dismissed his servants. He and Chade sat with glasses of wine, talking quietly on the cushioned bench beneath the window that looked out over our wake from our dimly lit cabin. I rose and left Thick's side, and going to the table beckoned them. Weary as they both were from a long session of stones with Lord Excellent, they were still intrigued enough to immediately join me. I spoke to Dutiful without a preamble. "Has Webb ever confided to you that he knows I am Fitzchivalry?" The look of astonishment on his face was answer enough. "Did he need to know that?" Chade grumbled at me. "Is there a reason to keep such knowledge from me?" The prince replied for me, more sharply than I would have expected. "Only that this bit of intrigue has nothing to do with our present mission. I would keep your mind focused on the matters that most concern us, Prince Dutiful." Chade's voice was restrained. "Perhaps, Counselor Chade, you could let me decide which matters concern me." The asperity in Dutiful's voice warned me that this was a topic that had been discussed before. "Then there is no sign that anyone else in your witted coterie knows who I am." The prince hesitated before replying slowly. "None. There has been talk, from time to time, of the witted bastard, and when I think back, Webb has initiated it. But he brings it up in the same manner in which he teaches us witted history and traditions. He speaks of a topic, and then asks us questions that lead us deeper into understanding it. He has never spoken of Fitzchivalry as other than a historic figure." A little unnerving to hear of myself as a historic figure. Chade spoke before I became too uncomfortable. "Then Webb teaches your witted coterie formally? History? Traditions? What else?"
"Courtesy.
He tells us old fables of witted folk and beasts, and how to prepare before beginning a search for an animal partner. I think that what he teaches are things that the others have known from childhood, but he teaches them for my benefit and Swift's. Yet, when he tells tales, the others listen closely, especially the minstrel Cockle. I think he possesses much lore that was on the verge of being lost, and he speaks it to us that we may keep it safe and pass it on in our turn." I nodded to that. When persecution broke up the witted communities, the witted had to conceal their traditions and knowledge. It would be inevitable that less of it was passed on to their children. Why, do you think, does Webb speak of Fitz chivalry? Chade asked speculatively. I watched Dutiful think it through, in the same way Chade had taught me to ponder any man's action. What could he gain by it? Who did it threaten? It could be that he suspects that I know. Yet I don't think that is it. I think he poses it to the wit coterie to make them consider what is the difference between a ruler who is witted or unwitted. What would it have meant for the six duchies if Fitz had come to power at that time instead of being executed for his magic? What might it mean for the six duchies if it ever becomes safe for me to reveal that I am old blood? And also, how does it benefit my people, all my people, to have an old blood ruler? And how can my wit coterie assist me in my reign?
In your reign? Chade asked sharply. Do their ambitions run that far ahead of us? They had spoken of aiding you on this quest, to show the six duchies that the wit can be put to a good cause. Do they think to continue as advisers beyond this task?
Dutiful frowned at Chade.
Well, of course.
When the old man knit his brows in irritation, I intervened. It seems natural to me that they would, especially if their efforts do assist the prince in his quest. To use them, and then cast them aside afterward, is not the sort of political wisdom you have taught me over the years. Chade was still scowling.
Well, I suppose. If they truly prove to be of any value, they would expect some compensation.
The prince spoke levelly, but I could sense him holding his temper. And what would you expect them to ask in return if they were a skill coterie aiding me? He sounded so like Chade as he set his trap question that I almost laughed aloud. Chade bristled.
But that would be entirely different. The skill is your hereditary magic, as well as being vastly more powerful than the wit. That you would bond with your skill coterie and accept both counsel and companionship from them would be expected.
Then he stopped speaking abruptly. Dutiful nodded slowly.
Old blood is also my hereditary magic, and I suspect there is far more to it than we know. And, yes, Chade, I do feel a bond of both companionship and trust with those who share that magic. It is, as you said, to be expected.
Chade opened his mouth to speak, then shut it again. After an instant, he opened his mouth, but again subsided. Irritation vied with admiration when he said quietly,
"Very well, I follow your logic. I do not necessarily agree with the conclusion, but I follow it."
"That is all I ask," the prince replied, and in his words I heard the echo of the monarch he would be.
Chade turned his beetling gaze on me.
"Why did you bring this up?" he asked me crossly, as if I had sought to precipitate a quarrel between them.
"Because I need to know what it is that Webb seeks from me. I sense that he courts me, that he tries to draw me closer into his confidence. Why?"
There is no true silence on board a ship. Always there are the ongoing conversations between wood and water, canvas and wind. Those voices were the only ones in the cabin for a time. Then Dutiful gave a small snort.
"Unlikely, as you think it, Fitz. Perhaps he only wishes to be your friend. I see nothing here for him to gain."
"He holds a secret," Chade said sourly. "There is always power in holding a secret."
"And danger," the prince countered. "Revealing this secret is as dangerous to Webb as it is to Fitz. Think what would follow if he revealed it. Would it not undermine my reign? Would not some of the nobles turn on my mother, the queen, angered that she had kept this secret from them and preserved Fitz's life?"
In a lower voice he added,
"Do not forget that in revealing to Fitz that he knew his identity, Webb put himself at risk also. This is a secret that some men would kill to preserve."
I watched Chade sift it through his mind.
"Truly, the threat is to your reign as much as to Fitz," he conceded worriedly. "Right now you are correct. It benefits Webb most to keep the secret a secret. As long as your reign is amiable toward the witted, they have no interest in deposing you. But if you ever turned against them, what then?"
"What then, indeed?"
Dutiful scoffed. "Chade, ask yourself, as you have so often asked me, what would happen next? If my mother and I were overthrown, who would seize power? Why, those who had overthrown us, and they would be the enemy of the witted, a harsher enemy than old blood has had to confront in my lifetime. No, I think Fitz's secret is safe. More, I think he should set aside his wariness and become Webb's friend." I nodded, wondering why such an idea made me so uneasy. "I still see little benefit in this witted coterie," Chade muttered.
"Do you not? Then why do you ask me each day what Webb's bird has seen? Does it not ease your mind to know that all the ships she has shown Webb have been honest merchants or fishing vessels? And think what tidings she gave us today. She has flown over the harbour and town of Zillig, and Webb has looked down on it through the bird's eyes. He has seen no massing of folk as for battle or treachery. True, the city is swelled with people, but it seems to flaunt a festive air. Do you not take comfort in that?"
"I suppose so, but it is a thin comfort, given the treachery is so easy to disguise." Fick rolled over, muttering, and I made that my excuse to leave them. Not long after, Chade departed for his own cabin. The prince went to his bed, and I made up my pallet beside Thick's bunk. I thought of Webb and Risk, and tried to imagine seeing the ocean and the out-islands through a bird's eyes. It would be a marvel and a wonder. Yet before my imagination could capture me completely, a wave of longing for night eyes swept over me. That night, I dreamed my own dreams, and they were of wolves hunting in the summer-seared hills.
Chapter 8. The Hetgird. This is how it was. Ada and El coupled in the darkness. But he did not find favour with her. Then she gave birth to the land, and the outrush of her waters which accompanied that birth was the sea. The land was shapeless, clay and still, until Ada took it in her hands. One at a time, she moulded the runes of her secret name, and El's too, did she fashion. She spelled out the god name with the god's runes, setting them in careful order in the ocean. And all this El watched. But when he would have taken up clay of his own to fashion his own runes, Ada would not give any over to him. "You gave me but a rush of fluid from your body as seed to make all this. The flesh of it came from me, so take back only what was yours to start with, and be content with it." El was little content with that. So he made for himself men, and gave them ships, and put them on the sea's face. Laughing to himself, he said, "There are too many for her to watch them all. Soon they will walk on her land and shape it to my liking. So it spells my name instead of hers." But Ada had already thought before him, and when El's men came to land, they found Ada's women already walking on it, and ordering the growing of fruit and grain, and the proliferation of the cattle. And the woman would not suffer the men to shape the lands, nor even to abide on them for long. Instead, the woman said to the men, "We will let you give us the brine of your loins, with which we will shape flesh to follow ours. But never will the land that Ada bore belong to your sons, but only to our daughters." Birth of the World, as told by Out-Island Bards. Despite Chade's misgivings, Webb's bird had shown him accurately what we could expect. The next morning, the lookout cried out his sighting, and by afternoon the nearest islets of the Out-Islands were streaming past on our port side. Green-banked islands, tiny houses, and small fishing vessels enlivened a view that had been watery for too long. I tried to convince Thick to rise and come on deck to see how close we were to the end of our journey, but he refused to be tempted. When he spoke, his words were slow and measured.
"It won't be home," he moaned. "We're too far from home and will never get back there again, never.
Coughing, he turned away from me. Yet even his sour attitude could not dampen my relief. I convinced myself that once he was on shore, he would regain both his health and spirits. The knowledge that we were close to getting off that cramped vessel made every moment stretch into a day. It was only the next afternoon that we sighted Zillig, but it seemed a month had passed. When small boats rowed out to greet us and guide our ships through the narrow channel to their harbour, I longed to be on deck with Chade and Prince Dutiful. Instead, I paced the prince's cabin, staring out at the frustrating view from the aft windows. I could hear our captain bellowing and the thunder of the sailors' feet on the deck. Chade and Prince Dutiful and his contingent of nobles and his witted coterie were all up on the deck, looking on as the ship approached Zillig. I felt like a dog chained in the kennel while the hounds streamed off to the hunt. I felt the change in the ship's movements as our canvas was lowered, and the tow lines of our pilot boats took up their slack. When they had us in position, the out-island guides brought us about so that our stern now faced Zillig. As I heard the splash of our anchor, I stared restlessly out at the foreign city that awaited us. The other six Dutchies' ships were being manoeuvred into anchorage nearby. I do not think there is anything so ponderously slow as a ship coming into port, save perhaps the process of unloading. Suddenly the water about us swarmed with small craft, their oars dipping and rising as if they were many-legged water bugs. One, grander than the rest, soon bore Prince Dutiful, Chade, a selected entourage, and a handful of his guards away from the ship. I watched them go, certain they had forgotten about Thick and me. Then there was a tap at the door. It was Riddle. Freshly attired in his guard's uniform, his eyes shone with excitement.
"I'm to watch your half-wit while you get yourself ready. There's a boat waiting to take you and him and the rest of the guard ashore. Step lively now, everyone else is ready to go."
So they had not forgotten me, but neither had they served me with much warning of their plans. I took Riddle at his word, leaving him with Thick while I went below. The guards area was deserted. The others had donned their clean uniforms as soon as we'd approached harbour. Those who hadn't accompanied the prince lined the railing on deck, eager to be away. I changed swiftly and hurried back to the prince's quarters. Harrying Thick into clean clothing was not going to be pleasant or easy, but when I arrived, I found that Riddle had already undertaken that task. Thick swayed on the edge of his bunk. His blue tunic and trousers hung on his wasted frame. Until I saw him dressed, I had not realized how much flesh he had lost. Riddle knelt by the bunk, good-naturedly trying to chivvy him into his shoes. Thick was moaning feebly and making vaguely helpful motions. His face was crumpled with misery. If I had doubted it at all before, I was now certain that Riddle was one of Chade's men. No ordinary guardsman would have undertaken that task. "I'll finish that," I told him, and could not keep the brusqueness from my voice. I could not have said why I felt protective of the small man looking at me blearily from his little round eyes, but I did. "Thick," I told him as I finished getting his shoes on, "we're going ashore. Once we're on solid ground again, you're going to feel much better. You'll see."
"No, I won't,"
he promised me. He coughed again, and the rattle in it frightened me. Nonetheless, I found a cloak for him and heaved him to his feet. He staggered along beside me as we left the cabin. Out on the deck in the fresh wind for the first time in days, he shivered and clutched his cloak tightly around him. The sun shone brightly, but the day was not as warm as a summer day in Buck. Snow still owned the peaks of the higher hills, and the wind carried its chill to us. The out-islanders provided our transportation to shore. Getting Thick from the deck into the dancing boat below required both Riddle and myself. I silently cursed at those guards who laughed at our predicament. At their oars, the out-islanders discussed us freely in their own tongue, unaware that I understood the disdain they expressed for a prince who chose an idiot as his companion. Once settled on the seat beside Thick, I had to put my arm around him to settle him against the terrors of a small open boat. He wept, the round tears rolling down his cheeks as our little dory rose and fell with every passing wave. I blinked at the bright sunlight glancing off the moving water and stared stolidly at the wharves and houses of Zillig as the straining sailors rowed us to our destination. It was not an inspiring view. Piotr Blackwater's disdain for the city was not misplaced. Zillig offered all the worst aspects of a lively port. Wharves and docks jutted haphazardly into the bay. Vessels of every description crowded them. Most were fat-hulled, greasy whale hunters with a permanent reek of oil and butchery clinging to them. A few were merchanters from the six duchies. I saw one that looked Chalcedian and one that could have been Jamalian. Moving amongst them were the small fishing boats that daily fed the bustling town, and even smaller craft that were hawking smoked fish, dried seaweed, and other provisions to the outward-bound vessels. Masts forested the skyline, and the docked ships grew taller as we approached them. Beyond them, I caught glimpses of warehouses, sailors' inns, and supply stores. Stone structures predominated over wood. Narrow streets, some little more than trails, meandered amongst the crowded little buildings. At one end of the bay, where the water ran shallower and rocky, unfit for anchorage, little stone houses clustered by the water. Rowing boats were pulled out above the tide line, and spread fish hung like laundry drying from poles. Smoking fires in trenches beneath the fish added flavour as it preserved the catch. I glimpsed a pack of children racing along the beach, shrieking raucously in some wild game. The section of the town we were approaching seemed recently built. In contrast to the rest of the settlement, the streets were wide and straight. Timber supplemented the native stone, and most of the structures were taller. Some had windows of swirled glass in the upper stories. I recalled hearing that the six duchies' dragons had visited this port city, bringing death and destruction to our enemies. The structures in this area were all of an age, the streets straight and well cobbled. It was strange to see this orderly section amongst the haphazard port town, and wonder what it had looked like before Verity Asdragon had paid a call here. Stranger still to think that the destruction of war could result in such rebuilt tidiness. Above the harbour, the land rose in rocky hillsides. Dark evergreens hunched in sheltered areas. Cart tracks wound among the hillsides where sheep and goats grazed. Smoke wandered up through the tree cover from scarcely visible huts. Mountains and taller hills, crowned still with snow, loomed beyond them. We had arrived on a low tide, and the docks towered above us, supported on thick timbers crusted with barnacles and black mussels. The rungs of the ladder up to the dock were still wet from the retreating tide, and festoons of seaweed hung from them. The prince and several boatloads of nobles had already disembarked. More buckkeep noblemen were unloading as we approached. Grudgingly, they gave way to us to allow the prince's guard to clamber up the ladders onto the docks and form up to escort dutiful to his welcome. I was the last out of the tippy little boat, having shoved a moaning thick ahead of me up the slippery ladder. Once on the docks, I moved us away from the edge and looked around me. The prince, flanked by his advisers, was being greeted by the Hetgird. I was left standing to one side with Thick, unsure of what was expected of me. I needed to get him to a place where he would be comfortable and out of the public eye. I wondered uneasily if it would not have been wiser for me to remain on the ship with him. The open looks of disgust and dismay that he was receiving did not indicate a warm welcome for us. Evidently the out-islanders shared the mountain opinion of children that were born less than perfect. If Thick had been born in Zillig, his life would not have lasted a day. My status as both bastard and assassin had often left me lurking in the shadows at official proceedings, so I did not feel slighted. If I had been alone, I would have known that my task was to mingle and observe while being nondescript. But here, in a foreign land saddled with a sick and miserable simpleton and clad in a guard's uniform, I could do neither. So I stood, awkwardly, at the edge of the crowd, my arm supporting Thick, and listened to the exchange of carefully phrased greetings, welcome and thanks. The prince seemed to be acquitting himself well, but the look of concentration on his face warned me not to distract him with a skill query. Those who had come to meet him represented a variety of clans, judging by the differing animal sigils featured in their jewellery and tattoos. Most were men, richly attired in the lush furs and heavy jewellery that signified both rank and wealth among the out-islanders. But there were four women also. They wore woven wool garments trimmed with fur, and I wondered if this was to show the wealth of their landholdings. The Narcheska's father, Archon Bloodblade, was there, along with at least six others displaying the boar of his clan. Piotr Blackwater accompanied him, his narwhal and ivory carving on a gold chain around his neck. It seemed odd to me that I saw no other narwhal sigils. That was the Narcheska's maternal clan, and among the Outlanders, her significant family line. We were here to finalise the terms of the marriage between Dutiful and her. Surely it was a momentous occasion for her clan. Why did only Piotr come to represent them? Did the rest oppose this alliance? The formalities of greeting satisfied at length. The prince and his entourage were escorted away. The guard formed up without me and marched off behind him. For a moment I feared that Thick and I would be left standing on the docks. Just as I was wondering if I could bribe someone to take us back to the ship, an old man approached us. He wore a collar of wolf fur and sported the boar sigil of Bloodblade's clan, but did not seem as prosperous as the other men. He obviously believed he could speak my language, for I could understand about one word in four of his barbarously mangled Dutchy tongue. Fearing to insult him by asking him to speak Outlander, I waited, and finally grasped that the Boar clan had appointed him to guide Thick and I to our lodging. He made no offer to assist me with Thick. In fact, he assiduously avoided getting any closer to him than was absolutely necessary, as if the little man's mental deficiency was a contagion that might leap to him like a plague of lice. I felt it as a slur, but counselled myself to patience. He walked briskly ahead of us, and did not slacken his pace, even though he often had to halt completely to wait for us. Obviously he did not wish to share the gawking stares we attracted. We made a strange sight, me in my guard's uniform and poor miserable Thick, swathed in a cloak and staggering along under my arm. Our guide led us through the reconstructed part of town, and then up a steeper, narrower road. Thick's breath was a moaning wheeze. "How much further?" I demanded of our guide, calling the words to him as he hastened ahead of us. He turned abruptly, scowling, and made a brusque motion for me to keep my voice down. He gestured up the street at an old building, all of stone and much larger than the houses we had passed in the lower part of town. It was rectangular, with a peaked roof of slates and three stories high. Windows interrupted the stonework at regular intervals. It was a plain and functional building, stoutly built, and probably amongst the oldest structures in the town. I nodded, unspeaking. A boar, his tusks and tail lifted defiantly, was etched into the stone above the entry. So, we would be housed in the Boar clan's stronghouse. By the time we reached the courtyard around the building, our guide was practically chewing his moustache in his teeth-gnashing impatience at our slow pace. I no longer cared. When he opened a side door and gestured me to hurry, I slowly drew myself up to my full height and glared down at him. In my best Outlander, and all too aware of how poor my accent was, I told him, "It is not the pleasure of the prince's companion that we hurry. I serve at his command, not yours." I saw uncertainty wash over the man's face as he wondered if he had offended someone of a much higher rank than he knew. He was somewhat more courteous as he showed us up two steep flights of stairs and into a chamber that looked out over the town and the harbour through a swirl of thick glass. By then I'd had enough of him. I gauged him as a lesser lackey to some minor Boer war leader. As such, I dismissed him brusquely once we were inside and shut the door, even though he lingered in the hallway. I sat Thick down on the bed and then assessed the room quickly. There was a door that connected to another, much grander chamber. I decided that we had been put in a servant's room adjacent to the prince's quarters. The bed was adequate, the furnishing simple in Thick's small room. Even so, it seemed a palace after his closet on the ship. "Sit there," I told Thick. "Don't go to sleep yet."
"Where are we? I want to go home," he mumbled.
I ignored him and stole through into the prince's chamber. There I helped myself to a pitcher of wash water and a basin and drying cloths. There was a platter of food on the table. I was not sure exactly what it was, but took several pieces of a dark, sticky stuff cut in squares and an oily-looking cake covered with seed. I also took a bottle of what I thought was wine and a cup. Thick had toppled over on his bed. Painstakingly, I hauled him upright again. Despite his groaning protests, I made him wash his face and hands. I wished that I had a tub to put him in, for he smelled strongly of his days of sickness. Then I forced food down him, and a glass of the wine. He complained and snivelled until he hiccuped. Once I felt him marshal his skill strength against me, but it was a weak and childish swipe that did not even challenge my walls. I pulled off his tunic and shoes and put him to bed.
"The room is still moving," he muttered petulantly.
Then he closed his eyes and was still. A few moments later, he gave a great sigh, stretched out in the bed, and fell into a true sleep. I closed my own eyes and cautiously tiptoed into his dream. The kitten slept in a tiny curled ball upon the embroidered pillow. He felt safe. I opened my eyes, suddenly so weary that I could have cast myself down on the floor and slept where I fell. I didn't. Instead, I used what was left of the clean water. I sampled the food, found it unpalatable, and ate it anyway. The oily one was probably intended to be some sort of sweet. The other tasted strongly of fish paste. The wine was something fermented from fruit. Other than that, I had few ideas about it. It didn't quite take away the fish taste from my mouth. Then, armed with the basin of soiled water, I left the chamber to venture out into our lodgings. If anyone questioned me, I was simply looking for a place to dump the slops. The building was as much stronghold as clan residence. We were on the highest floor, and I heard no sounds of other occupants. The interior walls featured carved and painted boars and tusk motifs. The other doors on the hall were not locked. They seemed to alternate between small chambers such as Thick had and larger ones, more generously furnished. None of them met the buckkeep standard for guest housing, even for lesser nobles. I reserved judgment on that. I doubted they intended to insult us. I knew the Outlanders had different customs for hospitality than the Six Duchies did. Generally speaking, house guests were expected to provide their own victuals and comforts. We had come here knowing that. The wine and food in the prince's room seemed to be a nod to the Six Duchies' hospitality the Narcheska's entourage had enjoyed at Buckkeep. There were no signs of any servants on this upper floor, and I doubted that any would be supplied to us. The next floor down seemed much the same. These rooms smelled as if they had been recently used. Odours of smoke, food, and, in one case, wet dog lingered in them. I wondered if they had been vacated for our use. Chambers here were slightly smaller, and the windows were of oiled skin rather than glass. Heavy wooden shutters, some bearing the old scars of arrows, offered protection from any determined assault. Evidently the highest chambers were accorded to those of highest ranks, very different from the Six Duchies, where servants were given the upper rooms so that nobility need not climb too many flights of steps. I had just closed a door when I heard footsteps coming up the stairs. An ant trail of servants suddenly appeared, bearing belongings, comforts and victuals for their Six Duchies masters. They halted in confusion, milling in the hallway, and one asked me,
"How do we know which chamber is for who?"
"I've no idea," I replied pleasantly. "I'm not even certain where we are to dump slops." I slipped away from them, leaving them to sort out the rooms, suspecting that the best ones would go to the nobles with the most aggressive servants. On the ground floor, I found a back door that led out to a waste pit behind the privies and dumped my water there. Another door led down a corridor to a large kitchen where several young Outlander men were tending a large roast on a spit, chopping potatoes and onions and kneading bread. They seemed intent on their tasks and all but ignored me as I peered in at them. A quick tour of the outside of the building showed me that a second, much grander door led to a large open hall that made up much of the ground floor of the building. These doors stood open to admit both light and air. Within, I glimpsed what was undoubtedly the welcome gathering for the prince. I abandoned my basin in the deep grass at one end of the building and hastily straightened my uniform and smoothed back my hair into a tail. Unnoticed, I slipped into the back of the room. My fellow guardsmen were ranged against the wall. They looked as alert as men do when they are stiflingly bored and ignored. In truth, there seemed little for them to guard against. The large room was long and low-ceilinged. The main part of it was taken up with benches, all of a height and all full of seated men. There was no throne or dais of any kind, nor were the benches oriented to focus attention on one person. Rather, they ringed the room, leaving the centre open. A bowed old Kaempra, or war leader of the Fox Clan, was speaking. His short jacket was fringed with the tips of foxtails, white as his unruly hair. He was missing three fingers on his sword hand, but wore a necklace of his enemy's finger bones to compensate. He tugged at them nervously as he spoke, glancing often at Bloodblade, as if reluctant to give offence, and yet too angry to keep silent. I only caught his closing words.
No one clan can speak for all of us. No one clan has the right to bring bad luck down on us all.
As I watched, the Fox Kaempra nodded gravely to each corner of the room, and then retired to his bench. Another man stood and made his way to the centre and began speaking. I saw the prince and Lord Chade seated amongst the nobles who attended him in one section of the benches. His wit coterie was ranged behind him. The Hetgird, for so I recognised this assembly, the gathering of the warrior leaders of the clans, had accorded my prince no indication of his rank. Here he was seated as a warrior leader among his warriors, just as the other clan warrior leaders were. This was a gathering of equals, come together to discuss the Narcheska's betrothal. Did they see him so? I tried not to scowl at the thought. All this I grasped in the time it took my eyes to adjust to the dimness of the hall after the summer sunshine outside. I found a piece of wall to lean on next to Riddle in the back row of guardsmen. Riddle spoke out of the side of his mouth. "Not like us at all, my friend. No feast or gifts or songs to welcome our prince. Just a how-d'ye-do greeting on the docks, and then they brought him straight here and began discussing the betrothal. Right to business for these people. Some don't like the idea of one of their women leaving her motherlands to go live in the six duchies. They think it's unnatural and probably bad luck. But most don't care much about that, one way or another. They seem to think it would be Clan Narwhal's bad luck, not theirs. The real sticking point is the dragon-slaying bit." I nodded to his swift summary. Chade had a good man in Riddle. I wondered where he had recruited him, and then focused my attention on the man who was speaking. I noticed now that he stood in the middle of a ring painted on the floor. It was intricate and stylized, and yet still recognizable as a serpent grasping its own tail. The man did not give his name before he began speaking. Perhaps he assumed that everyone knew it, or perhaps the only important part of his identity was the sea otter tattooed on his forehead. He spoke simply, without anger, as if explaining something obvious to rather stupid children. "Ice fire is not a cow that belongs to any one of us. He is not cattle to be offered as part of a bride price. Even less does he belong to the foreigner prince. How, then, can he offer the head of a creature that does not belong to him as payment to the Blackwater Mother's House of the Narwhal clan? We can only see his promise in one of two ways. Either he has made his offer in ignorance, or it is an affront to us." He paused then, and made a strange gesture with his hand. In a moment its meaning was made clear as Prince Dutiful slowly stood, and then came to join him in the speaker's circle. "No, Kaempra Otter," Dutiful addressed him as warrior leader for his clan. "It was not ignorance. It was not intended as a front. The Narcheska presented this deed to me as a challenge, to prove myself worthy of her." The prince lifted his hands and let them fall helplessly. "What could I do but accept it? If a woman issued such a challenge to you, saying, before your gathered warriors, 'Accept it, or admit cowardice,' what would you do? What would any of you do?" Many heads in the assembly nodded to this. Dutiful nodded gravely back to them, and then added, "So what am I to do now? My word has been given, before your warriors and mine, in the hall of my parents. I have said I will attempt to do this thing. I know of no honourable way to unsay such words. Is there a custom here, among the people of the Narcheska, that allows a man to call back the words that have issued from his mouth?" The prince moved his hands, imitating the same gesture that the otter Kaempra had used to cede him the speaker's circle. He bowed to the four corners of the hall, and then retreated to his bench again. As he took his seat, Otter spoke again. "If this was the manner of your accepting the challenge, then I will take no affront towards you. I reserve what I think of Clan Blackwater's daughter for issuing such a challenge, regardless of the circumstances. I had previously noticed Pyotr Blackwater sitting almost by himself on one of the front benches. He scowled at the otter's remark, but made no indication that he wished to speak. The Narcheska's father, Archon Bloodblade, sat a small distance away from Pyotr, his boar warriors ranked about him. Archon's brow remained smooth, as if the rebuke had nothing to do with him, and perhaps by his lights that was correct. The otter had rebuked Eliania as a daughter of the Blackwater family of the Narwhal clan. Archon Bloodblade was a boar. Here, with his own people, he assumed the role that they expected of him. He was only the Narcheska's father. Her mother's brother, Pyotr Blackwater, was responsible for the quality of her upbringing. When the silence had stretched enough that it was obvious no one would offer a defense for what the Narcheska had done, the otter leader cleared his throat.
"It is true that as a man you cannot call back your word, Prince of the Farseer Buck clan. You have said you will try to do this thing, and I will concede that you must do it, or be judged no man at all. Yet that does not release us of the out-islands of our duties. Icefire is ours. What do our great mothers tell us? He came to us in the years before years were counted, and asked asylum from his grief. Our wise woman granted it to him, and in return for our sheltering, he promised that his protection should be ours. We know the power of his spirit, and the invulnerability of his flesh, and fear little that you shall slay him. But if, by some strange twist of fate, you manage to do him injury, on whom will his anger fall after he has killed you? On us. He turned slowly in a circle as he spoke, including all the clans as he warned them. If Icefire is ours, we also belong to him. Like a kin pledge, we should see the debt woven between us. If his blood is shed, must not we shed blood in return? If, as his kin, we fail to come to his aid, cannot he exact from us the blood price 10 times over, according to our law? This prince must honor his word as a man. That is so, but after, must not war come to us again, regardless of whether he lives or dies? I saw Archon Bloodblade draw a long, slow breath. I noted now what I had not before, that he held his hand in a certain way, open yet with the fingers pointing towards his sternum. Several men, I now saw, were making the same gesture. A request to speak? Yes, for when the otter warrior made the now familiar gesture, Bloodblade stood and came to take the man's place in the circle.
None of us want war again. Not here in the God Runes, nor in the prince's farmer's fields across the water. Yet a man's word must be satisfied. And though we all be men here, there is a woman's will in this as well. What warrior can stand before a woman's will? What sword can cut her stubbornness? To women, Ada has given the islands themselves, and we walk upon them only by her leave. It is not for men to set aside the challenge of a woman. Lest our own mother say, you do not respect the flesh you sprang from. Walk no more on the earth that Eda has granted us. Be abandoned by us, with only water under your keel and never sand under your feet. Is that easier than war? We are caught between a man's word and a woman's will. Neither can be broken without disgrace to all.
I had understood Bloodblade's words, but the full import of their meaning escaped me. Obviously there was custom here we were not familiar with, and I questioned what we had blundered into with our matchmaking. Bleakly, I wondered if we had not fallen into a trap. Was the Blackwater family of the Narwhal clan intent on kindling war between the 6 duchies and the Out-Islands? Had their offer of the Narcheska been a sham, to draw us into a situation in which, regardless of the outcome, we had invited bloodshed yet again to our shores? I studied Pyotr Blackwater's face. His expression was stolid and still, his eyes turned inward. He seemed impassive to the dilemma his sister-daughter had set us, and yet I felt he was not. I sensed rather that we balanced on the knife blade that had already cut deep into him. He looked, I suddenly thought, like a man without choices, a man who could no longer hope because he knows that no action of his own can save him. He was waiting. He did not plan or plot. He had already done the task he had set out to do. Now he could only wait to see how other men would carry it out. I was certain I was right, and yet what I could not understand, or even imagine, was why. Why had he done it? Or, as her father had said, was it beyond his control, the will of a woman who might be younger than he was and dependent on him, and yet controlled who might walk on the earth of his mother holdings? I looked around me. There were simply too many differences between us, I decided. How could the six duchies ever make a peace with the Outislands when our customs varied so widely? Yet tradition had it that the Farseer line had its roots in the Outislands, that Taker, the first Farseer monarch, had begun his life as an Outisland raider who had seen the log fortress that Buckkeep once was and decided to make it his own. Our lines and our ways had diverged far since those days. Peace and prosperity depended on us finding some common ground. The likelihood of that did not seem great. I lifted my eyes to find the prince's gaze fixed on me. I had not wanted to distract him before. Now I sent him a reassuring thought. Thick is resting in his chamber upstairs. He ate and drank before he went to sleep.
I wish I could be doing the same. They did not give me so much as a chance to wash my face before they convened the Hetgerd, and now it shows no sign of ending.
Patience, my prince. They'll end this eventually. Even Outislanders must eat, drink, and sleep sometime.
Do they piss, do you think? That's starting to be a very immediate concern to me. I've thought of excusing myself quietly, but I don't know how it would be interpreted if I stood and walked out now.
The hair stood up on the back of my neck as I felt a fumbling skill touch.
Thick?
It was Chade. I saw Dutiful start to reach out his hand to touch Chade and add his strength to the old man's. I stopped him.
No, don't. Let him try it on his own. Chade, can you hear us?
Barely.
Thick as asleep upstairs. He ate and drank before he fell asleep.
Good.
I sensed the effort he put into that brief reply. Nonetheless, I was grinning. He was doing it.
Stop. Silly grin.
He scolded me. He looked around the room, gravely.
Bad situation. Need time. To think. Need to stop this before it goes too far without us.
I made my face solemn. The expression was far more in keeping with that of those around me. Archon Bloodblade was surrendering the speaking circle to a man who wore an eagle badge. They paused to clasp wrists in a warrior's greeting before the eagle entered the circle. The eagle Kaempra was an old man, possibly the oldest man in the assembly. Grey and white streaked his thinning hair, yet he still moved like a warrior. He stared around at us accusingly, and then spoke abruptly, the ends of his words softened by his missing teeth.
Doubtless a man must do what he has said he will do. It wastes our day to even discuss that. And men must honour their kinship bonds. If this foreign prince came here and said, I have promised a woman that I would kill Orig of the Eagle Clan, all of you would say, then you must try, if you have promised to do it. But we would also say, but know that some of us have kinship bonds with Orig, and we will kill you before we let you do this thing. And we would expect the prince to accept that as obviously correct also.
His slow gaze travelled the assembly disdainfully.
I smell merchants and traders here, who used to be warriors and honourable men. Shall we sniff after six duchies' goods like a dog grovelling after a bitch? Will you trade your own kin for brandy and summer apples and red wheat? Not this eagle.
He gave a snort of contempt for all who thought there was any need of more discussion. Left the circle and crabbed back to sit amongst his warriors. A silence fell as we all pondered his words. Some exchanged glances. I sensed the old man had cut close to the bone. There were many here uneasy at the thought of letting the prince kill their dragon, but they were also hungry for peace and trade. War with the six duchies had cut them off from all trade from points south of us. Now the Chalcedian quarrel with the Bingtown traders was throttling that route. If they did not gain free trade with the six duchies, they would have to forego all goods and luxuries that warmer countries could provide for them. It was not a thought to relish. Yet no one there could oppose the eagle's stance without taking the name of greedy trader to himself.
We have to end this somehow. Now, before anyone adds their spoken approval to his words.
Chade's thin skilling sounded desperate. No one else stepped forward into the speaking circle. No one had a solution to offer. The longer the silence stretched, the more charged the room became. I knew Chade was right. We needed time to think of a diplomatic solution to our position. And if there wasn't one, we still needed time to discover how many of the Outlander clans would actively oppose us and how many would simply disapprove. Given the disapproval of the other clans, would the Narcheska persist in her challenge to Dutiful, or would she withdraw it? Could she honourably recall it? Here we were, not even a full day on this island's soil, and already we seemed on the verge of confrontation. Adding to my discomfort was that I was becoming aware of Dutiful's need to urinate. I started to shield myself from his skill, and then had a different idea. I recalled how Thick's uneasiness aboard the ship had spread to infect the sailors. I wondered if Dutiful's current discomfort could be used in a like manner. I opened myself to his unwitting sending, amplified it, and then sent my skill questing out through the room. None of the Outlanders that I touched had any strong aptitude for the skill, but many were susceptible to its influence in varying degrees. Once, Verity had used a similar technique to baffle Red Ship navigators, convincing them that they'd already passed key landmarks, and thus sending their ships onto the rocks. Now I used it to end this Hetgerd gathering by reminding every man my skill could touch of his urgent need to empty his bladder. All around the room, men began to shift in their seats.
"Doing?"
Chade demanded. "Ending this meeting," I told him grimly.
"Ah!"
I felt Dutiful's sudden comprehension, and then felt him join his persuasion to mine. "Who is in charge?" I asked him. "No one. They share authority here, or so they say." Dutiful obviously thought it a poor system.
"Bear opened meeting,"
Chade told me tersely. I felt him draw my attention to a man who wore a bear's tooth necklace. I was suddenly aware of how much strength it was taking from Chade for him to do this feeble skilling. "Don't tax yourself," I warned him.
"Know my own strength."
His reply was angry, but even from where I stood I could see his shoulders drooping. I singled out the bear and focused my attention on him. Fortunately for me, he had little wall against the skill and a full bladder. I pressed urgency on him, and he suddenly stood up. He came forward to claim the speaking circle, and the others ceded it to him with hand motions of giving.
"We need to ponder on this, all of us," he suggested. "Let us go apart, to talk with our own clans, and see what thoughts they have for us. Tomorrow, let us gather again, and speak of what we have learned and thought. Do any think this is wise?"
A forest of hands rose in spiraling gestures of assent.
"Then let our meeting be over for this day,"
the bear suggested. And just that quickly, it was over. Men stood immediately and began moving toward the door. There was no ceremony to it, no precedence for those of higher rank, just a push of men towards the exit, some with a greater insistence than others. "Tell your captain that you must check on your ward, that until he is fit, I have commanded that you continue to tend him. We'll soon join you upstairs." I obeyed my prince's command. When Longwick released me, I retrieved the washing basin I'd left outside the door and returned to Thick's chamber. He had not stirred that I could see. I felt his forehead. He was still feverish, but it did not burn as it had aboard the ship. Nonetheless, I roused him and coaxed him to drink water. He took little urging to down a whole mug of it, and then settled back into the bed again. I was relieved. Here, in this strange room, and away from the perspective of his sickbed on the ship, I could truly see how wasted Thick was. Well, he would recover now. He had all he needed. Quiet, a bed, food, and drink. Soon he would be better. I tried to convince myself that my hope was a fact. I heard Prince Dutiful and Chade conversing in the hall with someone. I stood and went to the door, ear pressed to it. I heard Dutiful pleading weariness, and then the closing of the door of the next chamber. His servants must have been waiting for him there. Again there was a murmur of conversation, and then I heard him dismiss them. A little time passed, and then the connecting door opened, and Dutiful wandered in. He held a small black square of the food in his hand. He looked depressed. He held the food up and asked me, "Any idea what this is?" "Not really, but it has fish paste in it, maybe seaweed too. The cakes with the seeds are sweet, oily, but sweet." Dutiful regarded the food in his hand with distaste, then gave the shrug of a 15-year-old who hasn't been fed for several hours, and ate it. He licked his fingers. "It's not bad, as long as you expect it to taste like fish." "Old fish," I observed. He didn't reply. He'd crossed over to where Thick slept and stood looking down on him. He shook his head slowly. "This is so unfair to him. Do you think he's getting better now?" "I hope so. His music has become so much quieter, it worries me. Sometimes I feel as if Thick himself goes away from us when his fever rises." I opened myself to Thick's music. Dutiful was right. It did seem less intense. "Well, he's sick. It takes strength and energy to skill." I didn't want to worry about him just now. "Chade surprised me today." "Did he? You must have known that he would keep at it until he could do it at least that much. Nothing stops the old man once he has decided to do something." He turned away from me and headed towards the connecting door. Then he paused. "Did you want any of that stuff to eat?" "No, thank you. You go ahead." He spoke over his shoulder. He vanished for a moment into his own room, then returned with one hand stacked with the fish cakes. He bit into one of the squares, made a dismal face, and then quickly ate the rest of it. He looked around the room hungrily. "Didn't anyone bring us food yet?" "You're eating it, I think." "No, this is just an out-island nod because we fed them. I know Chade told servants to find fresh food and buy it for us."
"Are you saying that Boar Clan isn't going to feed us?"
"They may. They may not. Chade seems to think we should act as if we don't expect it. Then if they offer us food, we can accept it as a gift, and if they don't, we don't seem grasping or weak. Have you informed your nobles of their customs?" He nodded. "Many of them came here as much to form new trading alliances and see what other opportunities the Out-Islands offered as to support me in my courtship of the Narcheska, so they are just as glad to move about Zilig, seeing what is for sale here and what people might want to buy. But we'll have to feed my guard, the servants, and of course my witcoterie. I thought Chade had arranged provisions."
"The Hetgerd seem to accord you little respect," I said worriedly. "I do not think they truly understand what I am. It is a foreign concept to them, that a boy of my years, unproven as a warrior, is assured the ruling of such a large territory. Here men do not claim sovereignty over an area of land, but instead show strength by the warriors they can command. In some ways, I am seen more as a son of my mother's house. Queen Katrikan was in power when we defeated them at the end of the Red Ship War. They are in awe of that. That she not only kept the homeland safe, but that she launched war against them in the form of the dragons she called down on them. That is how it is told here."
"You seem to have learned a great deal in a very short time." He nodded, pleased with himself.
"Some of it comes from putting together what I hear here with what I experienced of the Out-Islanders at Buckkeep, some from the reading I did on the way here."
He gave a small sigh.
"And it is not as useful as I hoped it would be. If they offer us hospitality, I mean feed us, then we can see it as welcome, that they know it is our custom and honour it. Or we can see it as insult, that we are too weak to feed ourselves and too foolish to have come prepared, but no matter how we see it, we can't be certain how they meant it.
Like your dragon slaying. Do you come to kill a beast and thus prove yourself a worthy man?"